Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Canadian author Trent Lewin. His fiction has appeared in Grain, a journal of eclectic writing, Dark Winter Literary Magazine, Syncopation Literary Journal, Rigorous Literary Magazine, and he has a story forthcoming in Boulevard Magazine. His stories have been shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize and the CBC Short Story Prize competition. His story, A Moment for Indra Singh, was a runner-up in the ex-Puritan's Austin Clark Prize for Literary Excellence. Today, I'll be reading his story, The Longest Day. But first, here's my interview with Trent, which took place on March 6th of this year. I'd like to welcome Trent Lewin to the podcast. How are you today, Trent?
Doing very well, John. Good to be sitting and chatting with you.
Yeah, I've been really excited about this conversation because you just got back from a business trip to a kind of an exotic place and you have kind of an exotic job that you do. Now, you're replying to me as Trent right now, but that's not your real name, is it?
It is not, no.
So you've chosen to go by a pen name, a nom de plume. This is a first for the podcast. I'm so curious about your choice. We had a conversation where you shared some of this with me, but for the listeners, I would love for you to share, you know, your thinking behind separating your other professional life with this life as a writer and how you came to that decision.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was a really well articulated decision at the time, John, to be really honest. Not everything goes exactly the way you think it's going to go. I think long ago when I started this pen name, my impression was because I am not, I'm an immigrant to North America. I arrived here not in a jurisdiction where I couldn't even speak the language. I was pretty young. It was pretty tough. And I grew up with, I think, a lot of baggage from that. And I still deal with that on an ongoing basis. I've always been writing, but I think when I finally decided that I'd like to put my writing out there, it really occurred to me that, look, I don't look like a lot of the writers that I read. I don't look like a lot of the writers that I see on TV. Is that a problem? So yeah, I made a really deliberate decision. I cannot remember how I came up with this particular name, but I came up with it and I said, okay, this is going to be the name. So that was reason number one. And, you know, I kind of regret that, honestly. I wish I kind of hadn't done that, but it's kind of done now. The second reason is, yeah, I do have a professional life. I do a lot of sort of technical work in the science and engineering field. And I feel that there's a little bit of a conflict between these two worlds, that they don't necessarily mesh together very well. They're not super compatible. So in my mind, it made sense to sort of keep them separate. And that's kind of how I arrived at this place.
And you told me that the only people in your life really who know that you're a writer are your immediate family members.
That's right.
And you've managed to keep this part of your life a secret from the rest of the people in your life. Is that hard or has it not been difficult, really?
It actually hasn't been that hard. I think if the secret sort of came out or whatever, it wouldn't really bother me that much. It's entertaining working to make sure my kids keep the secret because they love spilling the beans, right? They're relatively all still pretty young. And they like the notion of, oh yeah, we're going to tell this secret to all these other people. But it hasn't been that hard. And I don't put that much of a priority in it. It's not a closely guarded secret. It's just kind of a secret, I would put it.
Well, it's highly unlikely that anyone who'll be listening to this podcast will know you from your other professional life. So I think it's safe to say that, you know, you could probably speak fairly openly here today and word, it's probably not going to get out, right? I learned what your real name is. I'm not going to use it in respect to you. And I just love the kind of mystery man aspect to this. This kind of adds a whole little frisson of excitement to this that I haven't had the chance to deal with prior to this, and I'm loving it. You are based in Canada. You're in the Toronto area, I believe.
Very close to the Toronto area. Yeah, about an hour west of Toronto.
I wanted to talk to you about what you do for your quote unquote day job, because it's a pretty remarkable thing. It's really important work that you're doing. You are an environmental engineer Is that a term that you would use?
Yes, I would. Yeah, that's okay. The right term.
And you just returned from a business trip to Australia. And you mentioned before we started that you're still struggling with the difference in the time zones. And, you know, you're feeling the jet lag today. So I appreciate you doing this under those conditions.
No problem, John. But that's why I look and sound like this right now. I'm still not sure what time zone I'm in, but I'm recovering.
Well, you could have fooled me. You look and sound great. From where you were traveling, how long was that trip to Australia?
In travel time, it's about 23 hours total in flight time, with a couple stops or at least one big stop in there as well. So it's fairly long.
Wow. So yeah, you're going to be struggling for a while to readjust. But I do want to talk to you about what you were doing there in Australia and the kind of things that your work involves. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I work as an environmental engineer and sort of a research and development scientist a little bit as well in this field of sort of energy and the decarbonization of the energy world. My job is really to connect the dots around, you know, what's going on globally. What can we learn from other countries? What can we bring back here? What can we take from here to other parts of the world? And how can we really start reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the energy industry, given that it is the single biggest emitter of greenhouse gases? So that's where most of the work needs to happen. So really on this trip, I was going to Australia to see what is first in class over there. What are they really doing? What are they building? What does it look like? What does it cost? How does it perform? How many emissions does it really reduce? And how can we apply that knowledge to other parts of the world where we really need to do this as well? So it's actually a very complex job. It's very amorphous in some ways, because a lot of the infrastructure that we're going to need to build has never been built before. So you can't go into the back room and pull some plans for one of these things and just kind of replicate it. You got to build from new, which means you've got to do a lot of learning, and you've got to keep a really open mind about building things that you've never done before and accepting that there's some risk in doing that. So that's part of why I was over there, but I've been to other parts of the world as well to do sort of the similar thing, because everyone's doing this differently in terms of addressing climate change.
When you go on these trips, are you talking to government officials mostly, or is it a mix of industry executives, scientists, and government officials?
It's all of the above. I think it's really important to be talking to government and policymakers and decision makers at the policy level, because ultimately they're the ones who are going to drive the sustainability of the solution. You know, if someone could magically imbue some kind of legislation that lasts longer than a four-year political cycle, because climate change is a long-term issue, that's kind of the key to this, because we don't want changes in decisions and how we deal with climate change on that political cycle basis. So it's really important to talk to government. They're a key stakeholder, but it's also really important to go the other way and talk to people on the ground, local stakeholders, communities where people are building this infrastructure, to make sure that they're accepting of it and to at least explain what the benefits are. Because in some cases, you're building all these massive things. Like, picture a big wind farm. You're building a big wind farm in an area that's never had a wind farm, and suddenly these things pop up. How does the local community handle that? What's the benefit to them? Do they understand what the value of it is to them as a community? And then everyone in between, who are the people who are putting money into building these projects? How do you make sure that money is actually flowing and that we're seeing investment in green infrastructure, not just traditional oil and gas infrastructure? So that means you're talking to the oil and gas companies, because as much as the world is on a scheme of transition in terms of how we use energy, this is also a human transition. So what are all these people at these big oil and gas companies, you know, we go to fill up at their gas stations? They have lots of employees. What's going to happen to the employees as they move towards a clean energy future? What does that look like? How do they invest in that? How do their shareholders feel? So a lot of discussions with shareholders, the big multinational firms, developers who want to put cash into this, wealth funds and equity funds. I feel like almost everyone is involved in this conversation. It's a very, very rich tapestry of numerous stakeholders that you have to kind of bring together. And I feel that's part of my role, is attaching all these together on a common aligned goal of decarbonization and dealing with climate change.
Wow. No pressure there at all, I
No.
imagine. Wow. So there's like an enormous ripple effect. You have to like really look down the entire long-term line with this kind of thinking. I mean, it seems so overwhelming to me how you would even approach something like this. And in this instance, you were dealing with a democratic country. Australia, I'm sure, they're eager to try to institute these changes. Was that the case?
They are well ahead of North America in Australia in terms of actually doing this. That doesn't necessarily mean they're moving at the pace that they want to move at or that we as a world really need them to move at. I think, as a whole, this whole addressing climate change issue, we're not moving anywhere near as fast as we need to. And I think the Australians who have really taken a leadership position, they really feel that because they've done so much, but they know there's so much more to do. Democratic country, yes, they're aligned with this. Their new government is definitely aligned with it. Their state governments are aligned with it. So the alignment's good. They don't necessarily move as fast as actually, you brought up democratic countries, but I was just in the United Arab Emirates, which is not a democratic country. And I would suggest that they might actually be moving faster. But that's coupled with many other issues, right? Like, what are human rights really look like there? What are the other sort of competing factors in this? Their government can just click their fingers and they can make stuff happen, but at what expense? So there's, the nature of governments around the world and how they work and how we factor everything else into the equation in addition to the climate pressures, that makes an even more complex overall, challenge. I would call it a challenge. And again, we're not moving fast enough. I'm absolutely positive about that. We need to do a lot more and we need to do it a lot quicker and we need to do it everywhere because this is a global issue.
The importance of what you do, can't be measured, obviously. And it feels so hopeless sometimes and so futile the way people seem to respond to these concerns. Are you feeling optimistic?
I am. So don't be hopeless, Tom. Don't be.
If,
I want to buoy you a little bit and bring
all
you up
right.
a little bit. Don't be hopeless about this one because it is an immense challenge. I don't think we've ever gone through this before. We're going to change everything. We're going to change the whole world. We're going to need to. And sort of every day, every week, we get more and more people who are turning their attention to this. And the quality of the people I deal with inside my company, but also externally, is amazing. And their desire to do this is amazing. And I think if you have that kind of brain power and willingness all assembled at a problem, we will solve this. I absolutely believe we'll solve this. I wish we could go faster and that will happen. I'm hoping this turns into a snowball where we're just kind of at the top of the hill, but once this thing gets rolling, it goes that much faster. I think that's what's going to happen. Everything tells me that that is the case. So yeah, I'm more optimistic than ever, honestly. And I really do try to bring that message wherever I go.
Well, thank you, because that is a life-changing thing for to hear someone like you, feeling as hopeful and optimistic as you are. That is something I think we can all take away. Anyone who's listening to this episode, I think that will give them a sense of there being a future to look forward to for our children and our grandchildren. So thank you for that. And what you do in your work does filter into your writing.
It's not intentional, John. I think I actually try to separate the two as much as I can because I think fundamentally I feel this issue of climate change at such a sort of cerebral level, and I'm working on it in a technical sense all the time. You may agree or disagree with what I'm about to say. I feel like it almost diminishes the challenge if I try to put it into my writing. I don't want to belittle it by putting it into my writing. As though it's a fiction. It's not fiction. What we're dealing with is real and it's impactful right now. There are people around the world who are being impacted right now. There are island nations in this world that are sinking and that will be below high tide in a few years and their ancestral lands will be gone. And that is just such a fact. So I don't want to sort of, trade into fiction with this, but you're right. It does come through and I find myself unwittingly bringing that theme into the writing quite often, whether I want to or not, I just tend to go that way. So I think there's always going to be a flavor of this percolating its way into the writing because it's always on my mind.
And I really should have qualified that a little better. I would say some of your stories, it's more apparent in some of your stories, but it's certainly not
like an overriding, overarching theme in what you write. I just happened to notice it in one particular story, and there are vestiges of it in other stories. I think there's one story where I feel it kind of is more central to the story, The Reach, that you sent me, we're going to talk about. But I have so many questions for you about the stories, and I can't wait to get into that. But before we leave the topic of what you have just come back from doing in Australia, you write a blog post and you have a wonderful website. It may be the most recent blog entry, which is titled Alien Alien. I had asked you before we started if you would read a couple of paragraphs from that. Because while you're in a place like Australia, I'm sure there's a lot going through your mind about the place itself and the new experience of being in a place like Australia, you know, which is exotic and strange and wonderful. And, you know, as a writer, I'm sure you're kind of tuned into things in a way that other people that you're working alongside may not be. So if you could just read those couple of paragraphs I'd asked, it would be so much fun to hear them in your voice.
Sure, happy to. I'd like to propose a writing moment somewhere in this trip, but I haven't found it yet. The ideas keep welling up like they're going to swamp the roads here and overcome me. I mean, I'm not blank or anything. I have ideas, all that stuff, the stuff. That's what it's called when it builds up in you and requests admittance into this world. Please stay seated a little longer, I tell it. Don't unbuckle, not just yet. I got music blasting in my hotel room. I think I will disturb my neighbors, and when they knock on my door to complain, I will invite them in for a minibar drink. I'll tell them who I am and what I'm doing here, but I won't tell them about the stuff. I'm only telling you about that. Only you, whoever you are, wherever you are, happy or sad you may be, as I reach and reach and reach for whatever it is that links us together. Maybe it's the stuff. Maybe it's something we haven't figured out yet, because science is slow. Art is an exploration, and intersections between them can be measured in probabilities. Get on your bike, touch an ocean, say hello or good night, but make sure you say something.
Wow. Thank you. You read that so well, and it is just so full of good feeling and positive thoughts and beautiful expressions. Science is slow, art is an exploration, and intersections between them can be measured in probabilities. It's just such an uplifting message. And just maybe tell us a little bit about the impulse. Was it a moment that you felt, I have to just sit down and write about this? Or were you, I think I'll just let you describe what it was like to write that passage and what it felt like.
Yeah, I think it's sort of the equivalent of a bit of a mini expulsion. I think being as busy as I was during this trip, where I was out there for many weeks and just rushing from place to place and meeting to meeting, you know, there's not a lot of time in that kind of environment to sit back and really do a lot of the writing that's really calling on you to really be done. But that doesn't mean it's not there in my mind, right? Everything I see in places that I've never been before, it just gives me a new exposure and a new perspective to different people, different lands, different challenges, and all that kind of builds up and wants to turn into something. So, you know, I talk about the art part and the science part. I find those two things just clashing together because I'm seeing all this wonderful technology and all this beautiful science that's being done and implemented in this great engineering, and it means something. It absolutely means something that has an artistic, wonderful value to it. And then it's just a matter of when do you get that moment to let some of that out? And I think the blog post is just, you know, a little mini expulsion of letting some of that out. I think there's a lot more to come, right? Mm. Like, I think I've bottled up that Australian experience a little bit. And now I need to kind of actually write it out and determine sort of what that turns into in the world of fiction and how that affects the world of fiction. So there's the mini expulsion will be followed by, you know, a big eruption of something. And that will happen at some point is the way I think about it.
Well, that's an exciting thing to consider. And I love the term, the stuff. That's what it's called. And I use that expression too sometimes, the stuff. I think it's perfect. And yeah, the stuff that you come up with, Trent, I have to say, is pretty mind-boggling. I have just had so much fun, and I've been so moved by the stories I've read of yours. When I finish your stories, I really have to, you know, just kind of sit and let them settle because there's so much emotion in the lives of these characters. I'm not sure which story I want to start with. I want to try to get to as many as possible. I mentioned The Reach. Why don't we talk about The Reach? Is that a story that's been published or are you sending that out still?
It's soon to be published. Sent that into a literary magazine called Boulevard. It's a U.S. literary magazine that you're probably familiar with.
Mm.
And so it placed in a writing contest for emerging writers. Actually, it was first place in that contest. The edition with the story in it itself has not been released yet. I think it's coming relatively soon. So then it will actually be out in print. So it's just a sort of a matter of time now, I think.
Mm. It's such a beautiful story. It's a long short story. Did you get any pushback because of the length of it?
I don't think I really submitted it a whole lot. I may have submitted it to one other literary journal that was okay with stories. I think this thing is about 7,200 words long. So it's pretty long for a short story. But I think Boulevard's contest sort of encouraged stories of that length of up to that length of sort of 8,000 words. And I was really fortunate to get placed in that literary magazine. I subscribed to that one and I've read that magazine for many, 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 many years. It was a bit overwhelming to hear that they were going to place it. And it is long, but it honestly, in my mind, that story, especially sort of given the scale of it, it kind of needed to be long. I don't think I could have told that story in 3,000 words or 2,500 words. I just don't think I could have done it.
No, having read it, I would have to agree. And congratulations. I just can't imagine this not being published by the first readers who would have picked it up. And it's really unique in the way you've presented it as multiple narrators. There are shifting narrators in it. Not to mention that it covers like 1,000 years of time. And the main character, Ishin, has managed to be chosen for a project called The Reach, where one person would be sent into space and it would take them 1,000 years to reach this planet that the Earth was looking into as a possible place to colonize. That's the simplest way I can kind of give an overview of the story, but there's so much that happens in this story. He has a relationship with this woman, Alicia, who's a widow. So we do hear something at one point in her voice. So let's just start with the way you got into the shifting narrators, how you made those choices to structure the story that way.
Yeah. So not in a very deliberate, planned way, I would say. I think my writing process, to the extent that I have one, and I don't think I really have a very traditional one. I've not been taught to write and write. I've not been through school to, you know, this is how to structure and put things together. And I'm sure that's true of lots of writers that may be listening to this or who are out there. I think for me, I write very much on instinct. And I like this idea of this person on this really huge trip for a long period of time. And to me, in my mind, there are multiple reactions to what time really is going to do to you, right? To the inanimate objects of the world, which are included in the story. And you get sort of something from, you know, a tree, right? So you get a tree's perspective and then various other things. That sequence of time has to be impactful to more than just that main character. And then, so that's kind of how I thought of it. But also, I think I get really antsy writing from a single perspective if it's a longer piece. I think I want to explore different perspectives and they just kind of come up. They just intersperse themselves in order for me to keep the story sort of fresh and to keep moving. And I think that's why I kind of did that. Now, I always come back to the main character, but in between, I felt like there needed to be something more than just what he sees and what he's experiencing, even though his experience is quite personal. So I wanted to bring Alicia back into it, and you get quite a bit of her through the story and then these other narratives as well. To me, that's a way of sort of increasing the impact of the overall narrative, given it does span so much time and space. The time spans both, doesn't it?
Yes. And it's a tragic story because of the way time passes in the life of the main character. And, you know, the fact that he's kind of been cryo-preserved to be able to sleep through long periods. He doesn't age. And yet everything and everyone in his life passes away and is gone. And the world that he ends up in, when this ship that he was sent out in was launched, that was like the cutting edge of technology. But as you would expect, technology, it eclipsed that in all that time that he was in space. And at the end, he is looked at as a relic. There are these like a Carnival Line spaceship versions of the cruise ship where there are tourists looking at him. And he's become a tourist attraction in a way. And he actually, I think, says that I'm not a tourist attraction. So he's become irrelevant. It's a sad story, but in some ways it's an uplifting story because it's about surviving and moving on and finding a new way to exist in the world, which he manages to do in the world, in the universe. It is science fiction. That I think you could safely say, right?
I think so. You know, one reflection on that, I don't think Boulevard actually publishes science fiction. I think they purposely state that. So I think it's about those characters and the reflection on time and advancement and how humans react with each other and relate to each other and to our natural environment. Because there's definitely that eco-fiction piece, especially around the ending. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we relate to our natural environment? I think that's the core of it. But I thought the only way to actually bring that out in a really persuasive way was to stretch this over time, which required some of those maybe science fiction type elements to propel the story. Mm. But I think it's about that relationship between people and sort of their natural environment and each other. I think it's still that at its core.
Yes. And the relationship that we all have to time, it certainly goes well beyond the science fiction that most of us are used to, I would say. So
I don't know if this is an accurate reflection, but I do like this concept of blending genres. So mm-hmm. It's got the science fiction elements, but I think it's in that literary fiction category as well. And somehow those two things merge together in some way, shape, or form in that particular piece.
Mm. One of the things that struck me in reading this is that it brought to mind Kurt Vonnegut. It felt very much like something that he could have written. And, you know, we're going to talk, there is a Kurt Vonnegut connection in one of the other stories that we're going to be talking about very soon. But is Kurt Vonnegut someone who you read as a young man and felt might have been an influence in some way?
Actually, yes, absolutely, especially when I was younger. And I think, you know, you go back to Slaughterhouse-Five and this concept of slipping through time, that's a line that's used in that book quite a bit, and that never has escaped me. And, you know, there's a lot of slippage through time in this one as well. Mm. I think I have a lot of influences in the literary world from when I was younger, but yeah, Kurt Vonnegut, absolutely, that's one of them. And he does show up in my writing every now and then, implicitly or explicitly. Yeah.
Well, I think you would be very impressed with the originality of what you're doing and honored. I think a lot of people think of him as an influence. You know, when I talk to people, he's one of the first names that comes up. So I think that's nothing to shy away from. And Kazuo Ishiguro is another person who I thought of when I was reading this. Is he someone that you've read?
Absolutely. I think, I don't know how many times I've read Never Let Me Go now, but that book just... especially the ending. There's something about that ending and the amorphousness of these pieces of plastic hanging on a fence and this person who, you know, is a person, but is a designed person almost. And just seeing that, it's just, I love that book. I wish I could write something that impactful. I'd love to write a novel that impactful. I just thought it was absolutely wonderful.
Well, I think you have it in you, Trent. I think you could do it. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. So
thank you, John. No, I appreciate that.
I absolutely believe that. And now, since Kurt Vonnegut came up, the story A Moment for Indra Singh, there is a direct mention of Kurt Vonnegut in this story. And this is the story that I read that brought you to my attention. And it just knocked me out. This was a runner-up in Ex-Puritan's Austin Clark Prize for Literary Excellence. If you go to the website, there's a little blurb at the top of the story from Cody Caetano, and he calls the story a eulogy that doubles as an ode to storytelling before the opening sentence ends. This is another story that kind of breaks boundaries in lots of really wonderful ways. Time-space continuum, you're kind of breaking through walls all over the place in this story. It is a love story as well. It's about two people who meet in college. The main character, Indra, he's kind of an oddball, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's a good word for it.
Kind of a loner, someone who loves physics. And this relationship that forms with this other character, Arvinder, is kind of an unlikely relationship in a lot of ways. But it turns into this just really sweet, warm, and affectionate, even though it's not a consummated relationship. This is a real relationship. It's a real, boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. Can you pull up the story and maybe just read the first paragraph for us? Since we had talked about the Kurt Vonnegut connection, it'd be fun to have you read that first paragraph.
Sure. How I came to know that Indra Singh regularly went to other worlds was nothing more than a bookmark nestled in a Kurt Vonnegut book that came spitting out when I knocked the book off an end table. Indra was the type who would reread this book every couple of months, almost as though he missed the characters so much that he couldn't bear to be too far away from them. I often wondered if, given the chance, he wouldn't give up his life to snuggle into the pages and join Jonah in his quest for Ice-9 in a world of Nobel laureates and atomic bombs. A world of physicists, Indra said, one he would surely join, even if that meant he only had a bit part as a background character.
And that's obviously that's Cat's Cradle that you're referencing there. So for all the Kurt Vonnegut geeks out there, the cultural elements are really beautifully depicted, in great detail in this story. And maybe if you could just give us a little background into this character Indra, who we find later in the story has this ability to just vanish into thin air and visit other worlds that he comes back from and then makes these elaborate paintings of. Is this something that kind of occurred to you? Sometimes people say they have dreams about things and they use these as ideas for stories. And this story has a very dreamlike quality to it. So that is really my first question. Do dreams play a part in any of your story writing?
I think they naturally do and would. I mean, I often wake up in the mornings and, the first thing I'll do is whip out the notebook and I'll write something down, some snippet of whatever it happens to be. I think to your point around the cultural elements, though, I mean, I'm familiar with the Sikh culture and the Hindu culture and the Pakistani culture and Muslim culture. So I'm very familiar with all these. Mm. I think what I wanted to do here is tell a story from sort of that perspective. Without that being the main narrative. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to write a story that's got these, science fiction type elements, and I would ascribe that to the story, but told from the standpoint of people that we wouldn't normally expect to show up in one of these stories. And I think I really wanted to do that and bring in some of those cultural notes that I know about into the narrative, but again, not make it front-facing. It should be just, yes, these are Indian kids and they happen to be going on this absolutely massive journey together. And this, story of unrequited love and physics and painting and art. And again, it's that intersection between art and science that I really, really love. And I think I could explore that forever.
Your knowledge of science shows up a lot in these stories. You clearly have a wealth of knowledge about astronomy, which showed up in The Reach and shows up in this story. And with all of those kind of speculative aspects to the story, it's really a story about family and the love between a mother and a son and grief. The mother is a main character in the story who is suffering from a disease that's, causing her to basically wither away before Indra's eyes, Indra and Arvinder. And Arvinder becomes very close with the mother through the course of the story as well. And so I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, the mother passes. And when she does, the grief that they both experience kind of brings them closer together. So grief is central to this story. Grief is something I feel is in all of these stories in some form or other. Is something that you need to explore that comes up for you a lot.
It does, but I hope that I couple that with hope. I think, you know, I'm striving, I think, really hard to, yes, explore some of the maybe darker elements of what we all go through and that what I've gone through, and you probably have as well, John, and lots of people have. And I think it's not so easy to deal with these things. And I think I always want that glimmer of something hopeful that comes out of this or some resolution. I always want to have that duality in the stories. I don't want to tell the eternally dark tale that stays dark forever. I want to pull something hopeful out of that and something beautiful out of that. Because I think I felt that in my life, and I think we all do, and hopefully we all do, that we can pull something out of grief and turn it into something else. We're always going to have a bit of both in our lives. And I really want to kind of encapsulate that in the stories, I think, is the way I think of it. Mm. Yeah, and we all deal with things in absolutely different ways. I mean, Indra, obviously, he keeps disappearing. And the worse is grief, the more he disappears until he just does disappear. And, you know, I had a friend who likened that to dependency, you know, dealing with grief through dependency on substances and, you know, becoming more and more addicted to your escape from reality. And so maybe there's a bit of a metaphor in there as well, and maybe a bit of a dark one.
But it, as you say, it ends on a very hopeful note. And the stories do, you know, the reach for all of the suffering that the main character experiences, you know, there's hope at the end, you know, there's a future in sight for him. And that's the case too. You know, in this story, the one who seems to be suffering the most at the end is Arvinder. She's the one who is left wondering, where do I go from here? And it's really an exceptional story. I really want to see stories like this anthologized, you know, be part of an anthology. I don't know what happens after, you know, things like this ex-Puritan contest are over and done with, but, you know, this is the tragedy for me with the world of short stories, is that this story really deserves to have a life beyond that ex-Puritan contest runner-upship that you got from there. And
thank you, John.
It's something that I would highly, you know, recommend to people putting together anthologies, you know, and that could fit into many different kind of thematic anthologies, I think. So speaking about the industry, what's been your experience, you know, working with these independent journals? Do you feel like you've had experiences that you've learned from with them in many cases?
I think it's been really good, actually, but it does tell me how little I know about this industry. I mean, in my professional life, where I'm obligated to produce and produce on a schedule and with a budget so that my clients are satisfied with what they get, I kind of understand that mentality, and I'm always on the clock. I try to relate sort of my professional life to how the publishing industry works, and there's no simple analogy there. This is just a different beast, and it works by its own rules and has different mechanics. I think it's been great getting submissions out. I will say there was a point or a time when I sort of wrote and I published on the blog, and I did a lot of that. And I've stopped doing that. So I'll publish my thoughts on the blog, but the stories I'm more concentrating on actually submitting to some of the presses and some of the literary journals and contests. And that's been fantastic. I feel pretty validated by some of the successes I've had in that journey. The part I haven't quite grappled with is how to go beyond that. So I am really interested in, you know, putting together a book of short stories, which might be one way to create more life for some of these things. You know, I have enough content by far to put that together, but, you know, getting into full novels, which I love that length. I love that ability to actually explore. How does that work? How do you really appeal to the agenting community to go through that traditional publishing route? I have a lot to learn. A lot to learn. You know, I still consider myself sort of kind of a beginner on this journey in many ways. But I have a lot to say. And so I think these experiences help inform me so that I can keep asking questions and keep growing in this industry as well, where, you know, I'm a lot earlier in the journey than I am in my professional life.
I'm glad to hear that you're looking toward putting together a collection, because from your perspective on things, which is a very unique one, I think we need to hear the stories that you're going to write. I think they're important stories, and I think they're going to, you know, inform people, educate people. You know, they have the power to change people's lives. I mean, I really feel from having read your stories that my life has been changed in a way. And your hopefulness about the future, that's something that, again, you know, you can't put a value on the importance of that. And for you to be able to share that through these beautiful works of fiction, you know, that's an enormous gift to everyone who reads your work. So I want to just thank you so much for joining me today. I know, you know, you have a super busy life and, you know, you're jet lagged today. So you really went above and beyond, but I so appreciate you being with me and sharing all this with us today.
Well, thank you very much, John. And by the way, that is a massive compliment to someone like me. So thank you for that, because I feel like you're, I don't know how to even absorb that kind of language, but I really thank you for it. And I really appreciate this discussion. I don't get to have this kind of discussion very often about the writing life, but I've really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for asking some wonderful questions about some of the stories and about the professional career as well, and how these things intersect a little bit.
I'm very glad to know you, Trent, and I hope to learn more about your success as a writer very soon.
Thank you.
Be sure to visit Trent's website, TrentLewin.com, where you can read some of Trent's extraordinary writing in the form of blog posts, short stories, and even music. You'll find a song there, too, with lyrics written by Trent. And now we'll move on to the short story. Today I'll be reading The Longest Day, which you can read in one of Trent's blog posts on his website. So here it is, The Longest Day by Trent Lewin. "Can you give me your phone?" "What for?" asks Marla. Still, she does what he says, and Ben tucks it into his pocket like it's his. "Go ahead and climb ahead of me," he nods. The ladder is painted white. Marla touches it and wonders how many people have come up here before. "Can I have a hit first?" she asks. It feels like a sensible request, and not one that Ben would normally turn down. The first time she'd met him, he'd been so high that he couldn't remember her name. The memory problem has stayed with him. Sometimes he looks at her as though searching for her name, as though he has to walk miles to find the signpost where it's splayed on with loose staples flapping in the street wind. But this time he shakes his head. "I'm clean. I told you. Go on up." Marla puts her hands on the rungs above her head. In her mind, this is simple. This is only a ladder. She has come to this tower with a man who she has never slept with, though she suspects he has done something to her a few times when she has been passed out. Ben's eyes are purple, then green, then some other color that Marla fancies as the sweat begins to pool on her forehead, and she asks again for another hit. Then she is climbing. This is the tallest tower in the world, she is told. He has taken her up it successively by glass elevator, by stairs, by a service elevator, by three sets of narrow stairwells, and now, finally, this white ladder. The sweat is in her eyes, and her hands feel as though they are going to lose their grip. She wants her phone back, any kind of anchor to the ground that would remind her of what the street feels like. "There's a hatch," she says, encountering it first with the top of her head. The metal rings. Ben is a few feet below. He calls up the combination to the lock, and Marla puts the rings to their correct placement. She drops the lock, and somehow Ben catches it. "You're fast today," she tells him, the best compliment she has available. He nods to the hatch, which Marla shoves open to a view of stars and opalescent dreams, to the past and future clouds that muck up the heavens but are presently not available to obscure all the pale, waving light. A gust of air attaches itself to Marla's clothes, searching her body like a bouncer as she hauls herself up. "Stay down!" yells Ben. "Hold the railing on the side!" And then, suddenly, Marla is on a patch of round steel that is about the diameter of her body. Her fingers find the railing, maybe a foot tall, that runs around the perimeter of the circle and navigate their way to the vertical supports that anchor the thin strip of metal. She shimmies over so that Ben can follow her through the hatch. "I know you won't listen," says Ben, "but don't stand up. You don't need to unless you really, well, unless you just really need to." Marla feels the need to pee, but there is no facility present to allow her to do that, and she feels stupid asking Ben for a pit stop. "Look, can I have the hit now? This might be the world's strangest place for that, but I'm game." The hatch closes. It rings like a bell. "Ben?" asks Marla. "Hi, Ben! Open the hatch!" She closes her eyes. She waits, then, "Ben, open the hatch!" Marla starts to count. When she was 6, she had insomnia, and a family friend suggested that she count numbers out of order. So she does. It starts at 12 and involves every number from 0 to 200, all completely out of order, all imprinted in a sequence that only Marla knows, and that she suspects might be of importance somehow. She is counting. The numbers whip by. She is 6 years old again, golden and in a dress, and she is in a convertible, riding along the ocean with an ice cream in her hand. But the numbers end, and she has to open her eyes. She reaches a hand back and tugs on the hatch cover. It doesn't move.
"Motherfucker," she mutters.
Options absent, alternatives denuded, she pulls herself towards the railing and looks over the edge. This, she thinks, is only a city. There are hundreds of them in the world, thousands. They have been here forever. They are going to last until the end of the world. But the difference is that this one is entirely below her, a million streets lit with lampposts and headlights, storefronts and traffic signals. The blocks stretch everywhere, some so flat they are indistinguishable from the pavement, others reaching up towards her so grandly that had they been just a bit braver, she might have been able to reach out to touch them. Spotlights circle the city, all of them below her. Sounds climb the concrete of her tower, clomping, gargling voices and mechanical noises that rise like pyramids, with only the keenest sounds making it to the top, and those so worn out from the trip that she doesn't have a clue what they are anymore. Before her, to the south as she sees it, there is a great black emptiness of lake, the sporadic lights upon it just flirting, hinting notations that reflect on themselves and make the blackness all the bigger. In the distance beyond the lake, another city, then another one beyond it, and as far as Marla can see, endless reams of space going off in all directions. The tower is swaying. She realizes it when she stares at the lake and the shore, sees how they are seemingly moving. A second later, the kebab that she found in a garbage can on Front Street sails out of her mouth, a rainbow bridge arcing over the city until the wind snatches it up and tosses it back at her. Suddenly there is kebab in her hair and lettuce in her nose. She throws up again under the railing, letting her lucky meal descend into the faraway lights. "Ben!" she calls. Her voice is hoarse with acid. She remembers that he took her phone. Seemed like such a strange thing to do at the time. "Ben!" she screams. But it's a puny sound, not even really a sound at all at the top of the world. "Ah, oh, Ben!" she pleads. "Please, Ben, I really have to pee." She holds it in, knowing that Ben will come for her soon. Purple-eyed, green-eyed Ben, who claims that he's gone straight, and perhaps he has, and maybe this is just his way of scaring Marla so that she will go straight too. It's a lesson, she thinks, a detoxification next to the stars. But Ben doesn't come, and all Marla wants is a big roll of twine to wrap around her bladder, telling it to back off, that she's in control. Marla is sweating. The wind gusts in her face. She grits her teeth and holds on to the metal uprights, breathing against the swaying of the tower. When the urine comes, it feels warm at first, but cools fast. She lets it all go until she feels soaked and horrible. She has not showered in days, and now she is coated in her own vomit and pee. "Close your eyes," she says to herself, but the stars don't give her that luxury. "Don't listen," she whispers. But every now and then, something that sounds suspiciously like a car horn floats to her altitude, as though this is all a dream and she is about to wake up on a subway grate. "Don't believe in this," she continues. But the wind doesn't care about Marla's aptitude for belief, any of her convictions, had she had any, or where and when she might pick up any of these human characteristics that are commonly not associated with a mindless, yet bright blonde-haired junkie who refuses to get tattoos because she might pick up a disease. The wind, unfortunately, just blows. The tower sways under its heightening strength. Marla tips forward. It's not hard to lock her arms against the mild pitch, stopping herself from sliding forward, but she is ultimately more concerned about the larger view of the city she suddenly has. She can see straight down, or so she thinks, as she sways further and further until she is sure that her added weight has somehow destabilized the very top of the tower, enough that it will now simply snap and fall to the ground. It tips until her arms strain, and hangs in space for a moment before it jerks back. The return journey, of course, is much worse. The tower moves backward as though it's on a spring, picking up speed until Marla's arms straighten and her feet brush the railing behind her. The tower bucks until Marla feels like she's holding on to the top of a sheer wall with nothing behind her but endless equations made of gravity, all of which are strangely strong but not worth a damn in supporting her dangling feet. Forwards and backwards the tower sways, every time a little bit further. Marla is praying, but all that's coming out is memorized numbers, 0 to 200, a secret order she swore must be the key to unlocking some mystery of the world. But not today, definitely not today. The first raindrops feel like fingers. "Ben!" she screeches, thinking this is him touching her, but more mad at him than relieved. But Ben doesn't have a dozen fingers, let alone 50, let alone 100, let alone an ongoing pattering that never ends. It's falling in sheets as the tower sways, soaking her hair and her clothes, making her heavier still. There is wetness on her hands, seeping along the crevices of her fingers, threatening to neatly lubricate her grip on the metal studs. Marla's body slides over the wet surface of the tower's tip. She crashes hips and elbows and knees against the railing, picking up a bruise each time. When the wind gusts even higher, she is thrust forward and her elbows simply cannot lock. Her face smashes against the railing, knocking out teeth and filling her mouth with blood. Almost, her body flips over the railing and out into the tremendous space of the wind-blown city beneath her. What remains of her mouth she uses to clench the railing, torn-up gums chomping on the metal as her hands wrap themselves around the railing and anchor themselves there. Torn and bruised, Marla realizes that she never even saw the clouds come in. They just swooped down on her when she wasn't looking. That makes her laugh. She opens her mouth and drinks the rain, letting the cold water enter her like a waterfall. And still she is laughing, because not 3 hours ago she was raiding garbage cans for food, and the single greatest thing that had happened to her in the last month appeared in the form of a quarter-eaten sandwich wrapped in foil, a kebab, one that she has now neatly returned to the hard pavement where it was made. The tower sways, the rain picks up, and Marla kneels as though this thing she is on is a boat, and what's below her is just the ocean. Marla can swim. She knows how. Falling overboard is just a matter of kicking for the surface, she thinks, and emboldened by that thought, she pushes against the railing and stands up. Perhaps the wind has relented, or perhaps Marla has learned the swaying frequency of the tower's movements, but she doesn't fall. Instead, she rocks her weight from side to side, following the pitch and heave of the surface. Soon she is so comfortable with it that she raises her head and drinks more rain, the rain that is making her clean. Hands rip away her clothing and let it flutter into the wind, where it reassembles into a body shape, a type of Marla that is apparently able to fly. She can see it waving at her as it slips into the storm and then appears one final time in a flash of lightning. There are flashes of electricity everywhere, harsh bits of violence that seem anxious to hit her but invariably part into fragments that get lost in the lightning rods below. A bolt slashes so close to her that she could have reached out to touch it. She never realized that lightning was so big and so cold. Her body tingles as it passes. When the thunder follows, the tower shakes, the rumbles loud enough to make her remaining teeth slam against each other. "Motherfucker!" she screams, half an inch from being thrown into the wind, where her wingless spirit couldn't muster a single blessing to save her from the long downwards drop. Atop the tower, Marla is wild in the storm, arms upraised and screaming as the lightning plunges and the rain plummets and the wind hurtles her back and forth. Here she is the master of all the world, even though she has never even been master of her own body. The storm blows most of the night. It came from nowhere, and to nowhere it then recedes. Marla doesn't see it go. She is lying on the tower top sleeping, when the clouds break and the wind passes south over the lake. She is dreaming of absolutely nothing, aware of nothing but her own blackness. It is the best sleep she has ever had. It's the light that wakes her up. She opens her eyes and inspects her naked body. It is cleaner than she can ever remember, even her hair. The grime is gone. She is shining in the morning. She stands up. The tower is swaying, perhaps an inch from side to side. A siren calls to her from below. A snatch of sun finds its way up from the bottom of the lake, rising like a sunken battleship to the surface, where it spreads with the extent of its own lost treasures, rippling on the waves until the water is alive with light. In the distance, a city, and beyond that, another one. In between, space and everything that comes with it. Airplanes are flying overhead now, holding the only people in the world that are higher than Marla. She longs for a hit. Instead, she waves at the great white cruisers as they part left or right over the city. She breathes the air. It has a hint of spice, maybe gasoline, a measurable quality that is not exactly clean, but it is familiar. She is not sure if it is really possible to smell anything at this altitude, but it doesn't matter one way or another because the city is waking up. She can trace trains along the tracks, planes landing at the island airport in the lake, buses and trucks plodding along the roads. Behind her in the distance, a mega-highway alive with traffic and mysterious arterial chokings that threaten to stall the morning commute. And while there aren't other Marlas on other buildings standing in the early sunshine to wave at her, the sun catches these buildings as it ratchets up from its hiding place and makes them all, for moments at a time, golden. "I'm supposed to jump, aren't I?" asks Marla. The hatch hasn't stirred, and she knows somehow that it simply won't, that Ben isn't coming for her, or can't. She walks to the edge of the platform and looks straight down at the long strand of concrete that is holding her up. Then there is a noise above her, and a large red beast is coming down. Its twin rotors are madness against the blue of the sky, but it is growing larger and appears to know that she is atop the tower. A harness dangles towards the naked girl standing with hands upon her hips, and she takes it gladly. "I'm still supposed to jump," Marla thinks to herself, as she slips on the harness. But she is sick, so sick, of all the things that she is supposed to do, and the spaces that she is supposed to occupy, that she chooses instead, improbably, simply, to rise. The morning doesn't disagree. It's had its storm. The city below, too.
Thank you, Trent, for allowing us to read that gripping story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Jess Bowers. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories are